Welcome again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 7. Now, before we begin, we must not forget that we are living and working on Shkwempikulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Shkwempik people. It's clear that doing everything we can to resolve this situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. Now, today we have two guests on Food Conversations who address food security from a different angle than many guests in the program. Their role is to try and eliminate plants and animals that harm the food supply and disrupt ecosystems. Robin Hooper is the executive director of the Columbia Shuswap Invasive Species Society, and Jess Booth is the society's education and outreach coordinator. Together, they're going to help us understand how important it is to protect regional ecosystems by controlling or rooting out plants and animals that have intruded into those lands and waters with destructive effects. So, a warm welcome to you both, Robin and Jess.
Hello, good morning.
Delightful to have you with us on the show today. Now, at first glance, it might seem that fighting off invasive species is kind of a negative occupation, but what you do is actually far from it. Not only that, but the benefits can be far-reaching to local plant and animal populations. So let's begin with sort of a description of what the Columbia Shuswap Invasive Species Society, and I just call it the society, what it is and what it does. So maybe Robin, as the longtime executive director, it's been over 10 years now, why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. And thanks, Warren, for having us here today. Happy to speak about our organization and what we do. So the CSIS, like the spy agency, Columbia Shuswap Invasive Species Society, we are a nonprofit charity, and our aim is to prevent, reduce, and manage invasive species in the Columbia Shuswap region. And we have a variety of programs, and it's a really interesting group to work with, and we get a lot of work done, and I'm excited to share more about it today.
Started in April 2013.
That's right. Yeah, we started with a group of individuals coming together to collaborate and coordinate on invasive species. So invasive species don't know borders. They impact everyone. And so the land managers that got together were kind of thinking ahead in terms of how can we all get together in under the umbrella of a nonprofit society, and then eventually became a charity. And what that ensures is that we can work together in a collaborative manner and be more effective with the work that we do.
Yeah, collaboration, coordination, we'll talk about that later, but that really is a key part of what goes on. Now, the society joined is now part of a network that covers pretty much the whole province. I believe 13 organizations that look at this. And there's also a national and provincial invasive species organization. So it's, and I bet there's worldwide all sorts of people thinking about this as well. So it's not just local. And you're sort of under the, I guess, under the general management, if you like, of the Invasive Species Council of BC. That's sort of an overarching body. Now, I looked at the constitution of CSIS is good. I like CSIS. Mm-hmm. I was going to call it the society, but I don't know. People are going to get really paying attention to us if we call it CSIS. There's three roles, three purposes. One is to educate and engage the public, and that includes private landowners, managers of various communities and First Nations, etc., about invasive species and their impacts. The second is to carry out operations and operate invasive species management programs. But the third one was intriguing to me because it seemed very open-handed, to do all other things that are incidental ancillary to the attainment of the above purposes. That sounds like a lawyer, but it also is, it's very, Robin, when you think about that, that kind of opens the door to just about, you know, anything from flamethrowers to big bulldozers. So, when you're working, is that kind of a background thing that you have a lot of freedom to be as creative as you need to be to address the issues that come up?
Yeah, being a nonprofit society allows us to be really nimble and adaptable to change. And I'm glad you mentioned those purposes and our links to the other organizations. Yeah, we are an affiliate of a provincial society, and linked quite closely with our regional partners. And it's interesting, we're right now actually going through some strategic planning for the next 5 years. So I've been looking a lot at our constitution and our policies and frameworks. And I think what it boils down to is that collaboration and communication, which is through kind of engagement and outreach, the operational programs. And then the third one that speaks to, you know, all other things related is really also just about ensuring that we have a sustainable organization. And so what I see is like, there's a lot of things that kind of have to go on in the background to keep a society going and to ensure we have, you know, board succession and staff succession and that we're maintaining sustainable funding sources and things like that. But, but really the meat of what we do is collaborating with and coordinating the society in terms of getting other land managers, folks together to tackle these issues and then running operational programs.
Now, of course, not all species or life forms in the region who come to this region have negative effects. For example, ringneck pheasants are prized by hunters and they were introduced originally from Asia. The European honeybee was introduced from that continent to North America in the 1600s and is now considered a backbone of pollinated food production in Canada and the United States, although native pollinators play an extraordinarily important role as well. I just want to put out a call for that because we've had people who are very enthusiastic about native pollinators on the show and they have made that clear. It's also true that earthworms are mostly from Europe. There's a couple of species from North America, but most of the species, something like 17 I looked up, are actually from Europe. And in fact, in Ontario, in some areas, they're considered an invasive species in the negative sense because they eat up the leaf litter that's on the forest floor, which is considered valuable for other kinds of little critters. But why don't you give a succinct definition of what an invasive species really is, Jess, because you have to do outreach all the time. You probably have to tell people this. Why don't you tell our listeners what an invasive species really is?
You can do that. That is something we get asked very frequently. And often, depending on the group, I'd like to get some engagement and ask them that question too. Although for us, the working definition we use is something that is not from here, and we define BC as not here, has negative impacts on the economy, society, and the environment, and often we forget to bring the things that keep them in check when you bring them here. So a lot of things are brought maybe as an ornamental flower or a plant, but we forget to bring the things that would keep them in check, and that's often what I say to youth groups and communities to make that relatable. What else would you add to that definition?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, it's hard to define it really broadly because every invasive species has different impacts. But what Jess said, it's not from here and they have negative impacts in some manner. And I like to say that invasive species worldwide are the second greatest cause of biodiversity loss. So what we often hear is the environmental impacts, but we also like to mention that they have pretty severe impacts to the economy and to cultural values in society as well.
And that's very important because a recent article in The Guardian pointed out that biodiversity loss is one of the biggest drivers of climate change. Because when you have species that manage the environment for us, such as many kinds of trees, and you start to lose them, you're getting into trouble. So why don't we, I thought I'd bring forward an example, which just turned up a couple of days ago. It's an article in the Narwhal, which is a publication that deals with environmental issues. I'm glad to see both of you probably know it. And this is May 24th, which is just about a week ago. And this is the first few lines of the article. Riding Mountain National Park's boat ban is part of a growing trend across the country. The goal? Stop a tiny invasive creature that can produce 1 million eggs per year. Last November, researchers at Manitoba's Riding Mountain National Park made a discovery they have been dreading for years. In the shallow waters of Clear Lake, the park's crown jewel, they found a piece of rope coated in a clump of 48 living zebra mussels, one of the most ecologically devastating aquatic species, invasive species in the country. Now, I think lots of people have heard about zebra mussels, but but they certainly get attention because of what they are capable of. And the fact that you pointed out, Robin, there's no predators that consume zebra mussels for lunch. When you wander around the countryside, and it's a big countryside, by the way, that you guys have to deal with, Jess, you're trying to talk to people about zebra mussels because it must come up in conversations on a regular basis. What kind of conversations do you have about this? This article sounds dire. It sounds like people are really on edge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a great piece. We all sort of in our office read it this week, but it is an interesting conversation piece to have with people, zebra and quagga mussels, especially coming into our region, especially summer coming up too. It's something that we engage with people with really frequently. And I think trying to understand where people's values lie and where we can sort of help them understand how the impacts of zebra and quagga mussels would implement or influence their recreation, their activities. But it's not only that, like it extends much further beyond just our impacts. It's also got huge impacts for the environment and flow on effects on different ecosystems, especially in our region with Shuswap Lake, and also huge impacts on the economy. So I think we try and gauge who the people are and how we can sort of make it relatable and important to them as well.
And zebra mussels have a very important influence on an ecosystem. An aquatic ecosystem. They consume so much energy that they make life difficult for all the other creatures, including fish that people would like to eat or catch or whatever. Robin, we don't have zebra mussels yet in British Columbia. I'm saying this, my fingers crossed.
Yes, you're right. But do not yet have them. Yeah.
But the cost would be huge if we did have them. Could you talk about some of the estimates, the actual estimates of costs for zebra mussels if they were here?
Yeah, there was a report put out last year on the economic impacts of zebra and quagga mussels by the province. And the estimates range from $64 to $129 million per year. So huge estimate, or huge amount per year that it would cost just to manage the species should they get here. And we know this because other jurisdictions have invasive mussels. So we've learned from Ontario and parts of the United States that are managing it. And like you said, they're filter feeders, so they feed out the phytoplankton. So what that means is you have an ecosystem that's extremely, you know, devastated. So you have impacts to the fish in the water body, but you also have huge amount of infrastructure damage from this little invasive. So they're tinier than they're the size of your fingernail. They're tiny, and they attach to surfaces. So that's what makes them different from our native mussels. They attach, and so they can clog up water intake pipes, dams. And so what that means for infrastructure cost is huge, because there has to be cleaning regularly. So that's what that a huge infrastructure cost is.
Just to remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Robin Hooper, who is the executive director of the Columbia Shuswap Invasive Species Society, also known as CSIS, and Jess Booth, who is the Society's Education and Outreach Coordinator. Now, there's another animal, critter, that has also had a huge impact. It's in BC, and it's here for reasons that really, when you think about it, escape most rational thought. The American bullfrog. It's the largest frog in BC, came from eastern United States, and were imported to British Columbia, believe it or not, to grow frog's legs for restaurants. What an esoteric goal. As it turns out, nobody wanted to buy them. And so maybe one of you knows the origin story of their escape, but as far as I'm aware, they were just kind of dumped or just let out. Robin, do you know why that happened, that incredibly crazy thing?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny story. Sounded like a business opportunity for soldiers after the war. And they were released after the frog farming failed to get enough interest, I suppose. But we're very fortunate they're not in the Columbia Shuswap region. So all of our work is about preventing introduction. So if anyone has a frog, not to release it, we say, don't let it loose is the behavior change message. And luckily, I don't think there's many frog farmers in the region right now, but, you know, kids and families come to the region and pick up animals on the way and things like that. So just keeping animals in their home, or if you have any pets, not releasing them into the wild is the main message that we share.
And, you know, that's this example brings up a point that I think underlies a lot of what you have to do. And that is the fact that we humans can be incredibly dumb. Sorry for all my fellow humans out there, including myself. We can do things because at the time it seemed like a good idea, but we do not think of the world around us and what impact it's going to have. And this is a perfect example. The ring-necked pheasant turned out to, it was three times introduced to the Shuswap before it finally took. But that was because hunters all over the world were just crazy to go out and hunt pheasants. So they brought them in. Anyway, if you see there is a toad in Australia. Jess, would you like to talk mm-hmm. about that? As in terms of its ecological impact and what's happening socially as well, the cane mm-hmm. toad. Yeah.
Yeah, I can speak to the cane toad a little bit. We don't have them in our region here. So this is from my prior life in Australia, but they they're a big toad, very similar looking to our Western toads or even to the American bullfrog. And they're introduced to control a cane beetle and in the cane fields in northern Queensland in Australia. And they rapidly reproduced, which is a characteristic of invasive species. Right. And they have spread far and wide across a lot of northern Australia, nearly all of it, in I think three different states, which if anyone's been to Australia or looked on a map, it is a big place. And so, yeah, it's really interesting to see how species like that has made its mark. And it's kind of a lesson, I guess, to see, to note how quickly invasive species can spread. And
yeah.
I think Australia is a different kind of isolated example of how animals and plants and invasive species in general can impact place.
It almost makes you think that if somebody is going to bring any species, deliberately especially, to a new ecosystem, they have to be made to bring in the prey animals that go along with that organism. It's just insane. Anyway, there we are, a little insanity, part of human nature. Now, you folks have a really big area to cover, the entire Columbia Shuswap Regional District. I actually looked it up. It's just under 29,000 square kilometers. So it goes from Golden, actually beyond Golden, the eastern branch of the Columbia River, all over to Salmon Arm is kind of the westernmost end of it, and then it goes north quite a distance up into the woods. Before the show, I asked you if you'd ridden your horse, Jess, to some of the places where invasive species are going. It seems to me that you would probably at some point in life have to do that, because getting into some mountainous terrain would be inaccessible. How mm-hmm. do you get around if you're doing outreach work? How do you get around? What's your favorite conveyance besides Shanksmere, of course?
Well, we actually use vehicles for the most part, which may or may not be a surprise, but we do spend a lot of time in the vehicles. We have a hybrid vehicle that we use and an electric car through the Kootenai Car Share. And so a lot of it also then when it gets to those locations is by foot. We also are lucky enough to do some sampling for the zebra quagga mussels. And also coming up next week, we are having a boat drop off from one location to another on the rail trail project, which we're doing some surveys for. So not horses, which I think would be really fun. Maybe I can see if we can swing them. Do work with the backcountry horse chapter in the shoe shop to do some different community weed pools as well. So maybe one time I could swing a ride somewhere along the way.
I hope I've given you a good idea. And I hope you come riding into town on a horse, we'll know that that you really took it seriously. How do you establish in that huge area? How do you outreach? How do you know where to go? How do you find out that there's something to be done? What's outreach is a general term. How does it actually work in practice?
Yeah, so it kind of arises in lots of different forms. We spend a lot of time traveling to different communities. So It can be in the form of workshops, presentations. We go to a lot of farmers markets and environmental events. We also have a land manager meeting each year, so we extend that invitation to all land managers in the communities that we work in, and we get input from them about the different plants. But for outreach specifically, it's a lot of just connecting with people, networking, attending different events and meetings. We form a lot of partnerships that way, and I think over the years, I've only been here for a few, but that's been a really key piece. And I think we get a lot of people kind of curious and interested. Speaking of American bullfrogs, we have one that we have in a glass jar, actually, that got donated to us. And that draws a lot of people in at our events. So that's a great conversation topic or starter. It's,
they're pretty big critters. They're not tiny.
They certainly are.
Eight to nine inches long without the legs, apparently, which were the only parts anybody wanted to have anything to do with. What kind of groups are most interested in what you're doing? Obviously, farmers who have plants that are growing into their food crops or that are toxic and might affect other animals or them or humans. What is sort of the theme that comes up most often, or what are some of the themes that come up really often?
Oh, that's an interesting one. We get a lot. I think it varies. We have our whole aquatic program as well, so we connect with boaters and fishing groups as well, speaking about different issues like the zebra and quagga mussels that we spoke about earlier. And so I think based on people's interest, it kind of conversations can go anywhere. And it often is a great way to connect with people as well. So I'd say the themes are dependent on where we are and what we're doing.
Sure.
At an environmental market or a fair, we went to the shoe shop birthday gathering, and we had lots of people, whether it be, you know, teachers and different members of the community there, and also the fishing people, but all sorts of stuff.
I noted the structure of the society, CSIS, is sort of twofold. Robin, it's field work people and it's outreach people. Is that accurate? Because that seems to be the way it's made up. And obviously these two sides of what you do interact on a pretty intimate level.
Yeah, that's right. We have kind of divided them in that way in terms of positions, but because we're a small organization and we've got summer assistants that just join seasonally, we do a lot of crossover. And so if somebody is out doing an outreach event, there will be questions about the field work that we're doing. And if we're out doing field work, there will be outreach with the community members when we're doing the field work. So we cross-train everyone, and we also have our field staff attend outreach days and the outreach staff attend field days. So we're a really small group, and we all do a little bit of everything.
The creation of a team energy, a team spirit, a group energy. You talked about that before the show, and how important that is, and that you sense that is actually happening. Why don't you talk about how important working as a team really is, especially in a small group like this, and having a kind of congenial, open-ended atmosphere?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really important to me, and I think that we've done a really great job over the year at forming a really positive team environment. And it really makes and breaks any job if you have a good team of people that you're working with. And I think we're lucky. We have an organization that people are really excited to work for. They care about the work. They feel like it's meaningful work. And I work with great people. We all really input a lot of time and enthusiasm, but we've also really taken care to cultivate a culture that is, like you say, a friendly, caring environment. And yeah, really, it means a lot to me, and we've worked at it.
Another thing that struck me about the organization, and it's clear from a number of other organizations that are similarly working on things that need to be meaningful. In other words, you're not doing it just for entertainment or just for the money. You're doing it because you think it's important for the planet and for humanity. And struck by the fact that all but one of your workers are women. And that's interesting because the board, which is composed of mostly government representatives of different levels of government, is mostly men. There's only two women there. And there's only one man out of, what, seven in your staff. And we're seeing that a lot. And especially on this show, we often have people either commenting about that or being part of a group that is composed primarily of women. I wonder if you have any thoughts about that, Robin and Jess. But Robin, what are your thoughts about why women seem to not only be drawn to this kind of work, but also to be able to do a really good job at it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question. I feel like it's the trend, not just in this region, but provincially too. There's a lot of women working in invasive species. Mm-hmm. I think there's a few reasons. Like you say, there's just a general care for the planet. And also, I think there's something about working for a nonprofit that allows us to be flexible and adaptable should we have families. So I myself had a child a couple years ago, and there's something about working in this environment that also is just really favorable for making that work-life balance happen with, as a mother.
Did that change your perspective when you actually saw a human being in your life who is young and is going to be inheriting the world that you and I and others have been influencing, not always creating, but we certainly influenced a heck of a lot. Mm-hmm. Did that resonate for you, seeing this young person, this new human being?
Yeah, I think from a very young age, I cared about the planet and wanted to do meaningful work. But it touches a different level when you know that your offspring is going to be around. And I really love the mindset of thinking generations ahead. And now I really have another generation that I'm,
you do, you know, right there, looking at you, saying, "Mommy, what are you doing about my home?" Yeah. And remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Robin Hooper, the executive director of the Columbia Shuswap Invasive Species Society, and Jess Booth, who is the society's education and outreach coordinator. Now, Jess, you were involved with early childhood education or childhood education in Australia and here, and are involved with that with the society, but also with WildSight before you were with the Columbia Shuswap Invasive Species Society. What do you see that makes it so worthwhile and meaningful to talk to children about this, to see their eyes light? You wrote quite a few things in the WildSight website, which I glanced through, and a lot of it was, you know, the next generation, the young people. I mean, it's not that you guys are all that old, but it's that you're thinking a lot about children and bringing them into a relationship with the ecosystem.
Yeah, I think that's something I'm drawn to myself, but I think it's a great way to connect with people. And for a lot of reasons, I think invasive species often can have those sort of scary kind of connotations, but I actually think there's a lot that can be done that inspires people and instills like a sense of stewardship and care. And I think helping foster that and that curiosity that people have, and sort of encouraging them to feel empowered in their choices and making decisions that they can prevent invasive species or be involved in action events like our community weed pools. And I think it's really, really beautiful to see when an area that once had invasive species doesn't after some sort of weed pool and hard work. And there's a lot of great teamwork and camaraderie that can be built in those times. So things like that are really motivating for me. Like, they inspire me, and I'm always kind of leaving those times and those sessions that we have feeling uplifted and confident that the world is in good hands. And it's nice to sort of feel as though I played a small part in that potentially. So.
Yeah, I saw a couple of videos on, I can't remember if it's the WildSight website, and I don't know, I knew you were there somewhere in the videos, but the kids were having a blast. They were just having so much fun and talking about things that they'd learned. It was clear education for them was an easy task under those circumstances. Now, you yourself went to a university in Australia, the highly rated La Trobe University, named after some Caucasian gent who invaded the country himself some years ago. Mm-hmm. Now it's got campuses in Melbourne, and Sydney. Which one did you go to? Which one did you attend?
I actually went to a regional campus in Bendigo, which is central Victoria, or a few hours inland.
In the outback, sort of semi-outback.
Getting pretty close to the outback, only a stone's throw.
No, this particular university is part of a group of universities called the Verdant Universities. Now, did you know that secret of university?
I did not.
And the reason they do that is because they make a particular point on their campuses of greening them up. And because there's a lot of arid land in that part of Australia, it must be fairly dramatic to have that. Were you interested in plants and animals in the natural world when you were growing up? Because if you didn't know it was a Verdant University, you just took that as a given. But did you have, like the children that you are teaching now in the Columbus Shoeshop Regional District, did you have a yen to get out into the natural world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely did. And I think that was a huge driver for me to seek out a course that allowed me to be outside and connecting with people, because they're two things I like to do. And yeah, I was actually just chatting with my sister, who lives in Australia still, about this and how we just spent so much time outside when we were young, and we had a little stream that was nearby us, and we would collect and catch tadpoles and just sit there for hours. And I think that was a huge part of my draw, and wanting to also foster that in others, and also making it comfortable and not a scary place, because I think sometimes there's a bit of fear associated with the outdoors, and it doesn't need to be that way.
Oh, absolutely not. That's a construct of Western industrial society. Interestingly, your degree was a Bachelor of Natural Resources. Was there something about that? What did you want to get out of your academic training?
That's a really good question. I haven't been asked that in a long time. Not really since I started the program, but I think ultimately it turns out is what I'm doing now. I wanted to be able to work in the environmental world in some capacity. And I really think that working for an environmental nonprofit like CSIS has allowed me to do that. I've got the flexibility that I didn't know that I would need or want in my life. Especially I've come from, obviously, a long way. And
down under. Like it's on another planet. Why did you come to Canada? I mean, no, a lot of Australian young folk has come to this country for an experience. What was it about Canada and BC in particular, for example, that drew you in?
I think I was drawn to a totally different landscape. It's nothing like this exists in Australia. The mountains, the lakes, and also I think that was the draw, just wanting to see somewhere really different and learn about it. But also learning how diverse it can be and how much the seasons change is something that's really captivated me, and it's so distinct. And I fell in love with it and the community. So that was kind of unexpected, I guess, for me, but definitely something that's allowed me to stay.
And probably a little bit of skiing, a little bit of hiking, and a little bit of riding horses. And
all of that. I can do that too.
One thing that you made mention of in your sort of personal description was that you're doing basket weaving with Virginia creepers. Now, you got to explain this. Virginia creepers are an invasive species, and you're converting them into a useful product, if you want to call it, or creation. How did that come about?
I'm intrigued as how you found that out, because
it's right there for the entire world to see on the website.
Okay.
Yeah, be careful what you say. Yes. This is not going to get you into trouble.
No. I have this plant, an invasive species, growing in my yard. Mm. And every year in the spring, I go through a bit of a rampage, actually, kind of cutting back all of my plants. I have a bunch of fruit trees and blackberry, which is the non-invasive kind, just as a note. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I do have this plant called Virginia creeper that I've kind of inherited. And every year I think I cut it back and kill it, but I don't. And so I decided I would do something constructive with it. And actually I did make a basket. I tried my hand at making a basket and it actually turned out quite well. And I gave it to my partner as a gift to go foraging for mushrooms with. So I was surprised. It resembles a basket and functions. So great.
This is making lemonade out of a lemon in the first order. No, I think it's a wonderful idea. And what you're bringing out is that there's often a balance. What makes a species of some sort invasive is that there's no balance. There's no balancing predation, consumption. There's just consumption and reproduction because the critter that's come here has no enemies here and is prepared to deal with enemies, but there are none, so it just goes bananas, and then we have to deal with as humans. Mind you, we did create the problem in the first place. Robin, you have a somewhat different origin story. You moved when you were 2 years old to a place that half the world would like to live in, and that's Bowen Island. Your geologist father and your nurse mother moved to that bucolic setting when you're two. I bet you spent a lot of time outdoors. I'm just going to wager that with Tom here. You spent a lot of time outdoors.
Yes, I did. Bowen Island is a beautiful place to grow up. Yeah.
So what was that like, and how did it, you know, you have a father who is obviously interested in the ecosystem from a particular perspective. Your mother's part of a caring, health-oriented profession. What did that, what kind of environment did that create for you, both socially and in terms of the physical space as well, and your involvement with it?
Yeah, I think like Jess, I was really interested in the natural world from a young age. Did a lot of camping and hiking as well. And then I grew to be a bit of an activist in my high school years. And I think my parents really influenced that as well, just caring about the world and wanting to do good.
So what kind of activism were you involved? What specific things did you do?
Oh, I had all sorts of clubs that I was a part of. And I was involved in Kids Against Landmines work, like amnesty sort of work as well.
Sure.
I was very fortunate. It also led to kind of getting, I think I've told you this, I got into an international school that was all about kind of cultural understanding and kind of collaboration of nations.
And then you ended up doing university in a part of the world that puts collaboration and informal relationships among everybody as a theme, and that's Sweden. You got to a sort of conjoint degree, an interesting conjoint degree between a Swedish and a Canadian university. Why don't you talk about that? Because it's really an interesting story. It's a story about learning in a practical way the things that you're now doing, and in an academic way, the things you're doing in practical terms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I had been working for a while after my bachelor's degree and looking for master's programs, and came across one that was a European-Canadian coordinated degree. And so it allowed me to go to school in Sweden for a year and a year in at UBC in Vancouver, and pay Canadian tuition the whole time, and also receive kind of grants and honorariums to travel. But I love traveling and understanding different places. And it was a really interesting kind of, the work I did was kind of comparison of between Sweden and BC and looking at climate change adaptation and forest management. But really it was, you know, it's that time that you spend in another country and learning and a different setting with different students from different places that really fascinated me.
So what did you know about the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences before you actually landed on campus? I'll just tell you a couple of things I pulled off the internet. Recent events related to this university. An assistant professor just was awarded for his work on exploring the ecological impact of chemical pollution, named Michael Bertram. I don't know if you'd ever heard of him there and you're there. And then another one was about a project to look at how diverse crop rotations can give greater cereal leads, especially when the climate is changing. In other words, the diversity of the plant life allows for more productive growing of food. Did you know that this was that kind of place when you went there?
You know, this is like 12 years ago. It was a little while ago for me, but I had read the description online. I'd kind of, it all sounded good to me in practice, but you don't really know what you're going to when
you never do.
Early 20s and flying across the world to a new place. I was really happy with my choice. It was a great.
Did you know something about studying the Swedish way? Because it's front and center on the university's website. Mm-hmm. You're going to be mm-hmm. coming to study the Swedish way. Did you find the Swedish way a bit captivating? Because, for example, everybody goes by first name. Professors, students, nobody is set up higher. It's a horizontal hierarchy sort of system. Yeah. What was that like?
Yeah, there's a lot of pieces to that. It's interesting you bring that up because I feel like that's some of the culture that I've brought to CSIS is a horizontal learning environment where we're all learners together mm-hmm. and sharing and collaborating in the work that we do. And when I went to that university, I didn't think I would learn any Swedish, but I learned a bunch of Swedish and got to spend time with some indigenous peoples in the mountains where they're doing caribou herding.
Sami? The Sami people?
Interesting adventures. And I think one of the things I liked best about the education program there is they were small group and one course at a time. So we really got to focus on one subject at a time. And I found that going to university in Canada and having like five courses plus maybe four or five labs, it was a bit overwhelming the amount that we were packing into our heads at one time.
Yeah.
So that was something that I really enjoyed in Sweden.
They talk about the Swedish way also including group work and including critical thinking as a key, which I think is something that on this side of the Atlantic, we sometimes emphasize memorizing things and that kind of thing. Remind listeners, once again, I'm speaking with Robin Hooper, the executive director of the Columbia Shoeshop Invasive Species Society, and Jess Booth, who is the society's education and outreach coordinator. One thing that I'm struck by, and both of you, Jess and Robin, is that the number of courses in the academic world that relate to biology, both human and from other species, and ecological issues, and the relationship between us and the planet, and our planetary home itself, that course volume has increased astronomically in the last 20 or 30 years. When I went to university, they had zoology. I took zoology, one course in zoology, and that was like almost it. There were so much more limited. Now every nuance and aspect of ecological exploration is part of the intellectual world. It used to be considered, you know, the hard sciences were physics and pure chemistry, and biology was way too complicated to study and was not that important anyway. Have you noticed that creating a greater sense of awareness, both for yourselves, but the world around you, that people are willing to study the planet we live in? Jess, you know, you've seen two continents worth of work. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I have been lucky enough to experience that myself. And I guess similar to what Robin was sort of saying at university and just also through my experiences, there seems to be an awareness and I think so many opportunities to learn in more detail about the natural world. And I think it's a great thing that that's encouraged. And I feel so many people are drawn to being curious about that and have so many opportunities to have that fostered is such a great thing. And I feel like as well personally, so many of my connections and friendships are based around that interest in curiosity. And with the place around us.
And the expression on the face of children when they're exploring something in the natural world. I lived in an urban environment when I was growing up, but there were vacant lots. And where did I hang out? I hung out in the vacant lots. We would, you know, run around and, you know, wage mock wars that would never amount to anything. Robin, your thoughts about this kind of changing perception that is getting into academic settings, but also as part of the community at large?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's lots of work to be done, but we are seeing some change and interest in the topic. One example is with the Aquatic Invasive Species Program that we run. Some years back, we put together a group in the Columbia Basin to look at the risks to our water bodies for the invasive mussels, but other aquatic invasive species. And it's been great to see that taken up provincially, and there now being an inspection program for boats around the province, for example, and funding for monitoring the lake and doing early detection sampling work. So it's been really, I think, inspiring, of what Jeff said earlier, sure, to see some of the work that being picked up at various levels of government, and just an Indigenous interest in the subject as well. We're just really excited to work with all different types of groups and organizations.
In a way, it's almost like the ecosystem is influencing us, because in an ecosystem, everything is interrelated. It's not occurring in isolation or in a vacuum. And so the work that the society does revolves around collaboration, cooperation, interaction, feedback from one group to another. The list of organizations that the for example, the aquatic invasive species part of the work you do, it's Indigenous organizations, and communities and nations, it's ministries of the provincial government, the Invasive Species Council of BC, of course, is an overall group. BC Hydro is involved, the Fish and Wildlife Compensation Program, other invasive species organizations, the Columbia Basin Watershed Network is involved, Fortis BC and Columbia Power, which are commercial operations, are involved as well. I think one of the Fortis people is on your board. Parks Canada, it goes on and on and on. It's like you're reproducing the elements of an ecosystem in social terms. I guess you must like that. Tell me you like that idea.
Robin. Yeah, no, that's a lot of what we do is bringing all those people around one table and saying, hey, here are some things that we're worried about. How can we all work together is the gist of it. And like you said, we've got lots of folks on our board membership, but we've also just general members that come to our meetings and participate. And if anyone out there listening is interested in getting more involved, we're really open and transparent organization. We try and get everyone involved.
And if you can type out the Columbia Shuswap Invasive Species Society, you can get your ticket into the organization. Now, Robin, you touched on something a moment ago that we haven't really spoken about, and that is money. To do all this work, it requires some funds. It's the nature of the beast. How does that work?
It's a lot of what I do as executive director is
beg for money.
Get all the money to keep us going. We're very lucky though. We've had some core funding throughout the last 11 years in operation. And
where's that come from?
It was about 32 funding sources last year.
Okay.
So it's a big range, but I'll mention a few of our core funding partners that we're grateful for: the Columbia Shuswap Regional District, the Columbia Basin Trust, the province of BC, and that's through a variety of
ministries,
grants,
yep,
service works, right. Yeah, including the gaming grant, and Habitat Conservation Trust Foundation, which has funded a large invasive mussel lake monitoring program for us. And then we've got other kind of small programs and grants every year. It's a little different, but those are a few of our. Oh, and I should also mention the Shuswap Watershed Council has been a huge supporter for us for the invasive mussel.
They had monitoring. The Watershed Council has had a bit of problem with funding, as I understand. The CSRD board has voted either not to renew its funding, or there's some kind of. I was surprised to see that, because it's well known with some of the work it's done on Shuswap Lake. It's really achieved some important milestones that raised awareness and that kind of thing. Does that give you a sense? You have some core funding, so that sort of keeps the lights on. But in terms of advancing into other project areas, is that always something where you have to kind of scramble a bit and keep on coming out with new ways to apply for money?
Yeah, there's always some unknown as a nonprofit, we do have. We're lucky to have a few long-term agreements, and we're always looking for more to help us be more sustainable in our operations. But Things like that. There's a referendum, like you say, for the Shuswap Watershed Council funding. And that was a portion of their funding. But, you know, there's unknowns for our funders as well, right? And
sure.
Provincial budget cycles and things like that. So, we're always looking for new ways to support us and always welcome ideas from the public as well. And we have gotten involved with some fee-for-service projects with municipalities, for example, and Parks Canada. So little things that we kind of help to operate other groups' work. So.
Now, we should maybe talk, we've just got a few more minutes, about a project that everybody listening to the show probably has heard about. And it's sort of an example of what you do, what the society actually does. And it's the Yellow Flag Iris Weed Pull on White Lake. Now, I've known about it for a number of years. How many years has it been going on for now, Jess?
Wishing to correct you, it's Little White Lake that we've been working at.
Yes, indeed. Yes, Little
for
White.
For the weed pull.
To heck with Big White Lake.
We've also been working on White Lake with other partners.
Yes. Well,
two.
They do have, fortunately, the poster has the exact address where you park, so you know where to go. And it does say Little White Lake, if I would be more careful. So how does that structured? Who does what? How do you, it's not the first time that it's happened. How many years now? Robin or Jess, do you know how many years?
Well, we've been working with Little White Lake since the beginning, I'll just say, when I first showed up at CSIS.
Oh.
There's some really dedicated community members there, and Jess can speak to what that event looks like because she's been involved. But
well, I noticed the address where you park is the same for several years, so it's obviously that's one of your dedicated supporters. So, Jess, mm-hmm. give us the structure of this kind of event and how you do it.
It's one event that is, I don't want to have favorites, but it's one of my favorite events and weed pulls that we have each year. We generally have it every year. I think we have had it every year, maybe in 2021. It was scaled back a little with some of the restrictions we had, but it's a great day. We can use a private residence, which is a great sort of landing place for us to get together and then learn about the plant, Yellow Flag Iris, that is on the shoreline of Little White Lake. It's pretty easy to identify. It's got a big, bright yellow flower. If you do see the posters or the plants around. And so it's an interesting plant that there's a poster there that's just being shown, yes. And so we go around and deadhead the flower heads, so preventing them to go to seed, and pop them in bags. And we can do this on the shoreline, but a really fun part of it is we can get to canoe around the lake. So that's a great way to spend time out in the environment and kind of care for it too. And it's always a really fun time for everyone. And we get lots of community members involved.
And so people understand, because this is the nub of what you do. You're not going around destroying plants. You're going around protecting ecosystems by removing plants that don't have any natural limits to their spread. What would this Yellow Flag Iris do if you didn't have a weed pull and pull it back, as it were, from its prominence in the aquatic community?
Mm-hmm. So it's one that can spread very easily via its seed pods when they're released. They're a buoyant seed pod that sort of floats around and can move from one water body to another very easily. So that's an important part to remove it to prevent it from spreading to new places, but it also gets very dense along the shoreline, especially in those riparian areas. And so it competes with native species like cattail, but can also form sort of dense clumps that prevent other animals from using that space. And things like we see turtles up there, the red ear sliders, and there's a great community, the western painted turtles. The red ear sliders are the invasive kind, but the western painted turtles is a great group up there that does a lot of work to support the turtles in the area. And so a plant like Yellow Flag Iris makes it harder for those animals to live in those places. So it's has impacts like that are really direct to see.
So there's kind of a ripple effect. It's emphasizing what we've been really talking about all this show, and that is how there's a balance in nature. And when the balance is disturbed, very often by humans, us bright-eyed, bushy-tailed creatures who think we've got a really good idea, until we discover that Mother Nature has a very different view of it. And in fact, the ecosystem is paying a huge price for our creative efforts. We pull back, and then we start to say, Where's CSIS? Where is the Columbia Shuswap Invasive Species Society, which is the kind of CSIS that I would like to call, not the other kind of CSIS that we hear about in the news sometimes. It's really been a lot of fun. Robin Hooper, Jess Booth, it's been a lot of fun talking to you about the work you do and just realizing that you're out there looking at the dark side of human behavior and trying to lighten it up so that it becomes something that is no longer dark. It's contained and it's part of the balance of nature that we need to have around us all the time. So I want to thank you both for being with us today and wish you and the Society good luck in your efforts to make our human errors, correct our human errors and bring back balance into the world around us. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Aaron.